Hello and welcome to episode 106 of WB40, the weekly podcast with me, Matt Ballantyne, and Chris Weston.
Well, hello to everybody and welcome again to what is becoming a habit for us, releasing these podcasts every week. We haven't had a holiday for a little while, have we? So we're really cracking through them. And tonight we've got a special episode. It's a bit of a retro effort because we haven't got an interview. So it's just you and me, Matt, like the old days.
Yes. I had to remember what to do, really, won't we?
Well, you know, we just do what comes naturally, I guess.
Blather.
And you're a little bit croaky, aren't you, there, Matt? You're just from the exhilaration.
Yeah, no, I'm fine. It's fine. It's fine. I am a little bit croaky. I went to the football. I went to watch Watford play at Wembley yesterday, and there was much shouting, and there was much jubilation, and there were many goals scored. And so my voice is a little bit croaky as a result, but all good. And I'm going back there in May, which is fabulous news.
Yeah, all in good cause. And you know the summer started when FA Cup final comes. So it's one of those moments in the year that you think, here we go.
Absolutely. Although I have to say, Watford only ever done it once before, and the Cup final. And I was thinking back, because I was there, I was 13, 1984. And what a different world that was in terms of so many things, obviously. But the way the football world was, where the FA Cup used to be just about the only game that was played live on television all year. So it was this massive thing. They used to start at midday with Match of the Day on Grandstand.
The whole build-up, everything was great about the
helicopters going over the top of the coach that was going from somewhere out near Shenfield, driving into Wembley, and dubious celebrity appearances, as if, you know, actually looking back on it, extremely dubious celebrity appearances, because many of them would have probably been arrested if we'd known what they do now.
Bob Wilson is kindly managing of the whole situation.
Yeah, Bob Wilson isn't included in the
no
kind of U-tree kind of thing.
Good Lord.
But anyway, these days, of course, the FA Cup is, doesn't really have the cachet until you get an amazing game like we saw on Sunday. So, amazing thing being a football fan.
They have to find out at a different time now. Is it not at 3 o'clock anymore?
Something like that, yeah. It's all a bit wrong.
Yeah, terrible. Anyway, this is, and so you're listening to the Old Blokes Talk About Football podcast.
Anyway, so what have you been up to this week other than just listening to me blather on about amazing games of football?
So other than listening to you blather on about amazing games of football, I was listening to you blather on in a session that we were doing for our podcast customer this week. And I'm continuing to do lots of other stuff, doing some recruitment work and some still doing my regular stints with my splendid team who are building a stable coin for the Ethereum platform, and it's going to change the world, Matt.
Fantastic.
What about yourself, other than standing with me?
Well, other than doing the podcast, first phase of a piece of work with a client in Canary Wharf came to a close, so there's a number of things that may or may not come out of that. Some conversations with a company that actually both of us do some consulting work for about the podcast powered project stuff. So that's another route potentially that we'll be able to take that. It's weird as well. It's the end of the school term. Everybody's exhausted. We're now into school holidays, so the kids are around, but it's a weird one this year because my wife's supposed to be going off to the US for work next week. So it doesn't feel like a school holiday really, because work is continuing as usual in many ways. So, but we'll get a break over the long weekend in a couple of weekends' time.
It's exciting. It's a bit of a holiday. Doesn't do anybody any harm, except if you're working, and it's nothing but a holiday for the children, I suppose.
Well, yeah, that's it. Anyway, so what we got coming up on the show, given we have no interview this week?
We have no interview. So you and I, Matt, are going to talk about advisory services, because I did a little bit of a survey recently and got some opinions from some of the nation's finest technology minds on whether they what they find most useful about technology advisory services. And I'm talking about the Foresters and Gartners of this world, and IDCs, people who are They're building up research into products and methods, etc., and how they present that. And as CIOs, the people who buy this stuff, I was really interested to know what it was that exactly that they thought they were buying and what was most valuable to them.
Fascinating. I think it's a bit of a love them, hate them relationship in the IT world, I think, with the advisory companies. So it'd be interesting to dig into that a little bit. You've also prepared me for another quiz to see if I can do better than I did last week.
Oh yeah, I have. I was so excited and I so much enjoyed putting you through the ringer last week that I'm going to do it again this week. But this one, I think you'll get this one. I think this one's a bit easier, but we'll see, won't we?
We will. And we've got I Must Read It Again with me doing it. But it was kind of inspired by a book being mentioned in the Irish Times this week. So I thought it was time for me to open up people's minds to the wonderful world of Flann O'Brien. So should we start with that?
Yeah, let's go for it.
Who are you?
I'm Matt Ballantyne.
What do you do?
I'm the co-presenter of WB40, a consultant, advisor, writer, and Watford fan.
What is the name of the book?
The name of the book is The Third Policeman.
Who is the author?
It was written by an Irish author called Flann O'Brien.
When did you first read the book?
I first read the book probably when I was about 18. I'd read some of his short articles that were published in the Irish Times, but eventually got to work through Third Policeman probably the same when I was about 18.
Tell us briefly the main theme of the book.
The main theme of the book is a murder mystery. It's a murder mystery that's set in the rural lanes of Ireland and tells the story of three policemen, a man, a murder, and his bicycle. And the bicycles form a very important central theme within the whole story. And the principles of atomic theory determine that the people who are riding the bicycles, because of the interaction between the bicycles and their bottoms, the bicycles are becoming half human and the humans are becoming half bicycle. There's other ludicrous bits of physics, or not physics, that have stuck with me that are in the book. And the whole thing is actually a sort of descent into madness eventually, but it's beautifully written and very funny.
What impact has the book had on you?
I think the impact it had on me was this idea about being able to take what are seemingly logical ideas and then just extend them out so they become more and more ludicrous. One of the other themes, apart from the atomic theory, is that lights aren't actually emitting light, they're sucking in dark, which you can play around with in your head, and it's a fascinating thing to be able to experiment with turning around propositions that we hold, you know, completely as true. Utter nonsense, of course, but it's a good, fun read.
When did you last read it?
Probably about 15 years now since I last read it, which is why it's very much on my must read it again list.
If you could describe the book as an animal, what animal would it be?
I think it would be a curious bear, possibly a slightly deranged curious bear.
Well, thank you to, let's check, who's this? Yes, Matt Ballantyne for the I Must Read That Again. So we don't normally have the I Must Read That Again person on the podcast to talk about it. So I guess we should just take a few minutes just to say that's an interesting, we certainly haven't had a fiction book before, Matt.
No, well, there's been that sort of weird quasi-fictional stuff around DevOps, isn't there, with the Phoenix Project, but
yeah.
No, Flann O'Brien, Brian Nolan was his real name. He also wrote under the name Miles Na Gcopleán in the Irish Times. And a writer that my dad was sort of vaguely into, and I picked up a few of the books in my sort of late teens. And there's bits about the Third Police. It's really funny, but it's just really weird as well. There's another one that I didn't mention in the piece, which is... he talks about a knife that has got a blade so fine and so sharp that as you put it to your finger, it draws blood about an inch before it looks like it's actually entering into your finger because the atoms are so perfectly aligned. And it is, there's these like recurring themes of what on the face of it sound like they could be physics, but the minute you start thinking about them, you realise they're utter nonsense. And I just think there's something really captivating about that. But the... The Irish journalist Fintan O'Toole at the weekend wrote about how what he did was to use the third policeman as a series of themes to be able to explain Brexit, which, given the book is about a rapid descent into utter madness, it seems like at many levels an interesting way to approach it. So it's fabulous. It's well worth reading. There's also a radio version of it that was recorded in the 1960s that's available on the Internet Archive for free. So I'll put a link on the website to that. It's a 2.5 hour or so audio abridged version of it. But it's fab. It really is fab. And if you're not read it, you really should.
Great. A descent into madness, eh? We will talk about Brexit on one of these podcasts one day. I think that for the moment, if I was to think about a descent into madness as an allegory for Brexit, I'd be looking quite a long way back to find the point at which we became subterranean. We are long since past that point.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Back on with other things, though. You have got another quiz for me, which I'm slightly nervous about.
Well, you shouldn't be nervous, Matt. This is all an educational exercise. I think every day is a school day, isn't it? And here we are pontificating, as we often do, about technology and how it is applied and the kind of things that companies should be doing. So I think it's only right that we should be tested on our understanding of this, and you specifically, given that it's me doing the quiz.
So, yes.
Last week we did something around salaries, didn't we? And
yep.
Which I think was good. It was interesting. I think it had a bit of a debate about it. I don't think this one's quite as profound, but I think still it will test your memory and your knowledge of some of the software products that we all know and love.
Oh,
are you ready for this?
I am. So I've got
a pen and paper. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to read out four software products, and I want you to rank them in terms of the year that they came out.
Ooh, okay.
Okay. So the first one's Outlook Express.
Oh, that was the crappy email client that sat alongside Internet Explorer.
Yeah, exactly. It's free Internet.
Basically a rip-off of Thunderbird. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
And the next one is the Apple browser Safari.
Ooh, interesting.
The third product on my little list is Norton Antivirus.
Ugh, yeah. The Macintosh version of that I broke so many hard drives with. It was just a dreadful bit of software.
I'm not saying any of these pieces of software are things that I would necessarily recommend. And then the final one in our list is Microsoft PowerPoint.
Oh, okay.
So, have a think.
Right, so, what do I think? PowerPoint, was PowerPoint, it was a thing, wasn't it? Microsoft acquired it, and there
Microsoft
was another thing.
Acquired it, but it was acquired very quickly by Microsoft. They didn't hang around. It was basically
competition with a thing called Harvard Graphics.
Oh, yes. I used to have Harvard Graphics on a 3.
See, there we go. And so it existed when I started work in 1993. So it's 93 or earlier, I reckon. Norton Antivirus. Now, Antivirus kind of started a little bit later. So 95. Oh, no, maybe earlier. 92. Safari must have been related to OS 10. OS 10 first came out in about 2001, but it wasn't there at the start, I don't think. So let's go for 2004.
I must say, I'm not going to give away whether you're close or not, but I like the analytical way you're approaching this.
Analysis on occasion. When I put my mind to it, I can. Outlook Express was part of that phenomenon that was Internet Explorer, and probably was around Internet Explorer version 4, which would make it about 1998, but that might be wrong. So there we go. You want them in order. Norton Antivirus. PowerPoint, Norton Antivirus, Outlook Express, Safari, oldest to newest.
Do you know, you got them right.
Oh.
much to my disappointment. even though I did think this was an easy quiz, because there's a bit more of a gap between these.
I'm on a winning streak. That's what that is.
You are absolutely on a winning streak. And not only did you get them right, Matt, you were really, really close with the years as well. You weren't far off at all. Do you want me to give you the actual years?
Yeah, no, go for it.
Okay, so as you correctly surmised, PowerPoint was the first of those, but it was launched in 1989, I think I've written there. Or it's 1987, I can't read my own writing. Anyway, still very early on.
Oh, that's good, yeah.
The next one was Norton Antivirus, which she's so close to getting it wrong. I was on the edge of my seat. And that was launched in 1991. It wasn't.
Oh, I said 92, so that's not bad.
Yeah, it wasn't one of the first antiviruses, but it's one of the most enduring and well-known, of course. Outlook Express, you're absolutely right. It came out with Internet Explorer 4, and it came out in 1997.
Ah, oh, 1 year out.
And Safari is the most recent. I have no idea whether it was came with iOS 10, but it came out in 2003. And I think you said 2004, didn't you, Matt?
I did.
So, yeah, I'm very close. I mustn't ever give you one of these old man historical software product things again. You're just too good at it.
Yeah, see, you can ask me that and I can get it all within a year or so. Ask me where I've left my keys. Not a clue.
It's a sad decline, isn't it?
So for the bulk of the show today, we want to talk a bit about the world of CIO advisory services. Now that, if you work in the world of IT, is probably something you have some familiarity with. If you don't, you may not. It's something you've been doing some research into recently, and I think there's some interesting questions about why people spend quite a lot of money on these services. What they get from them, and also why they've not really changed very much, even though a lot of these services are talking about the importance of things like digital transformation. Probably to kick off with, it'd be an idea, though, just to be able to get a clearish definition about what the heck CIO advisory services actually are.
I think it's not that easy to define, because they're all slightly different, aren't they? The one that everybody knows, of course, the one that has got the biggest take-up is Gartner. They're the guys that seem to get the big news when they come out with whatever toss it is that they've decided that's going to happen in the next 2 years, or their 10 trends or whatever it might be. Those guys are they're the behemoth in this world. And what they tend to do is they'll do product research. So they'll look at a piece of software, like a new database technology, or even an existing one, and they'll rank it, won't they? They'll put it in their magic quadrant, and they'll say that this is a up and coming, and this one is what do they call it? You remember those things better than I will. In the magic quadrant, they have leaders and laggards. Is that what they have in the magic quadrant?
I don't know. I think there's stuff that's loosely based around the adoption cycle. They've also, of course, got the infamous hype cycle as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So they'll do those things, and then they'll rank products against each other. And if you're in the top right of the Gartner Magic Quadrant, then you're doing really well. And CIOs and people will point to that as a good reason to buy your product. So that's one service they provide. They also provide a bunch of other services around CIO advisory, around bringing people with experience to come and help you out and help you and your team with knotty problems. And that's pretty much the size of it in terms of a CIO advisory world. And of course they'll put events on as well. And Gartner, again, they're the guys that have the big symposiums, they call them, because they like those sort of words. And they do a fairly big one in Barcelona, don't they, for the European guys?
Yeah, they do. Where's the boundaries between a CIO advisory service and a consulting firm, one of the big four?
I think those boundaries are pretty fluid, aren't they? Because you will find that Gartner will do a kind of point consultancy, won't they? But I guess a lot of the difference is that a Gartner subscription is kind of a long-term general, be there to help you through various different things and point you to the right research that you might want to look at when you've got a problem. And the consultancy guys, I guess, are more focused around a specific project. They'll come in and do it, and then they'll leave you with a big book and a big bill. I think that's probably the difference between the two. What do you think?
Yeah, that probably it's a retained basis thing that's based around research as opposed to a per project funded thing that's based around winging it. Although there's probably winging it on both sides. I think there's another question in my mind is, surely isn't this expertise that's supposed to exist within the IT department? Why do people have to buy this in? Isn't this sort of knowledge something you'd expect your CIO and their team to be able to have?
I think that's a really valid point. And when, especially when you get a new CIO in role, there's often a lot to do. There's often they've gone into a role and their boss, whoever that might be, has said, one of the things we really want you to do is concentrate on delivering this piece of software or this functionality, or that we want to improve this thing or change the way the IT is proceeding the business or something like that. So they've got something to get on with. But actually, IT is a quite complex organization, and more so than probably any other part of the business other than the thing you do as a business. If you're a manufacturing company, you'll have lots of machinery and manufacturing. And IT has so many aspects to it in terms of projects and service and all of these things. So when you go into that sort of role as a CIO, you've often got to focus, but you've also got all this other stuff you've got to think about as well. You're protecting the company from risk in so many ways in terms of disaster recovery, compliance with data, regulation, security, all of these kind of things. So I guess, yeah, you're right. That knowledge should exist, but it's a little bit of a long way off sometimes, because there's a lot of very hard stuff to get right. So I think it's fair enough for people to say, do you know what? I'm not an expert in project management and infrastructure and disaster recovery and supplier management and ITIL and. You just can't be. I don't care who you are. Nobody's an expert in all of those things.
So you've been doing some research, asking people about what they are looking for from these services. What have you found?
Yeah, so I did a little bit of research. I was asked a question, and I thought I would throw it out to the masses and see if I could get some people in my network to help me out with it. So some of the people from the WB40 group answered this, and some other people that I know too. And it was kind of interesting to me, because I wanted to know, out of all the different things that a CIO advisory service did, what were the things that people found most valuable? And I'll quickly skip through the answers, because I asked about the kind of go-to services. So one is product research. Another one is community activity. Another one is advice. Advice. And by that, I mean advice about how you run your IT team and how you operate certain parts of it. Another one is around personal development. How does that CIO advisory service help you develop as a person and as a leader? Another one was about product comparison. So not just about research saying, oh, this is, if you want a, I don't know, manufacturing ERP system, here they all are and this is what they do. But there's also comparison saying, actually, if you compare the features of each one, this does that better than that, and number and C does those things better than A and B, etc. There's a bit around horizon scanning. So what's coming? What's the future state of these technologies? There's a thing about best practice. So how do you run a service desk if you're doing it absolutely to the book? And also there's things about big community events. So not just general activity, but having those big Barcelona type events. So the interesting thing was that those big community events came well down the list. They were very clearly last. Whilst I'm sure they are fun and everybody kind of likes them from getting together and meeting up with people, in terms of what they found in terms of the priority, and none of these things necessarily things people don't want, but it really lagged down the bottom in terms of the scores. And also I split up advice into advice in person and advice on the end of the phone, and the end of the phone advice also was right down the bottom. After that, things were much of a muchness. And at the top, we got product research, which I would expect to see, because that's kind of where these guys make their living and where their expertise is. But secondly, and quite clearly second, was community activity. So this is, when I posed a question, it was more around keeping you in touch with your peers and having more regular, smaller meetups around certain subjects. So people really appreciate that. And I think we see that, don't we, in things like the WhatsApp group that we run, that quite a lot of times you'll see people asking for advice on, has anybody done this, or has anybody ever used this product or this service or this company? So that's kind of, I think that desire isn't always matched with delivery, would you say?
Yeah, and I think the other thing is that the realm of these kind of consulting services has, the landscape in which they sit has changed dramatically. You know, the fact that you and I can set up a podcast and get a WhatsApp channel running alongside it and have about 40 or 50 people in there who have conversations about all sorts of stuff and a lot of it advising each other, that isn't reflected in the models that the likes of Gartner have for how they provide service to clients. And there are, I mean, you know, let's be blunt, there's a self-selecting group here. The people who get involved in networks associated with the podcast may or may not be the sorts of people who would depend on Gartner for advice. My hunch would be probably they don't, and that there are lots of CIOs who maybe don't have the networking nous to know that they could be doing this by other means. And so therefore that is the community. You know, they're buying, what you're buying essentially is a network of people that are, you know, paid to be your friends. The question for me though in all of this, and I mean, I've done work with advisory consulting firms, and this is something I've asked them, is what are the needs that are actually being driven? Because the in-person advice or on-the-phone advice or small group meetings or big group meetings or product reviews are things, but that doesn't actually look at what are the needs that are being met by those things. And I think when you actually start to unpack a bit about what are the needs that are being met by advisory services, it looks quite different. So there's an insurance against decision-making that I am buying from a Gartner, the ability to be able to tell my board I did due diligence by making a decision that was backed up by what it was that the industry-leading analyst was telling me. Now, that depends on Gartner being right. And one of the challenges with any of these sorts of organisations is actually how are they held to account for the predictions that they make? Because a lot of what they're doing is predictive. It's saying about trends. And I mean, if you look at the book Super Forecasters, the Tetlock book, what that tells you is that the stuff that's headline grabbing, the stuff that gets coverage in the media for people who predict the future, and this isn't just for IT advisory services, this is across the board, the stuff that is newsworthy and gets amplification in the media is the stuff that's least reliable because it's the most outlandish. And the stuff that is the most useful because it is the most predictable is short term and it's not very interesting. Because basically, if you want to predict the future, say tomorrow will be pretty much the same as today and you'll pretty much most of the time be right. But there's no headlines in that. So the thing about how these analyst groups are held to account, if they're in a position where they're helping people to be able to take risk out of the future, I think there's a debate that just isn't happening in that space. I think the other thing though is you can look at the needs that are being served by Gartner to the community of people who are subscribing to their services as CIOs. There's another set of needs which is possibly a bit more insidious, which is the needs that are being met for software vendors and IT service providers to market their products. And there's two things going on there. I've heard over many years, rumours about how the big advisory services effectively is a pay-to-play exercise, and to be included in ratings, you need to pay them money. But there's also a really weird thing, and I saw this when I was working at Microsoft to a small extent, and I've certainly seen it in other software companies as well. If you take something like the Gartner Magic Quadrant, which tells you what are the best products in a certain sector, Gartner define what the criteria for whether something is good or not, and then it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, because the R&D teams and the product development teams within software vendors will have one eye in being able to get themselves into the top right quadrant of the Magic Quadrant. So what they're doing is they're basically putting features in place to be able to get to the top of the quadrant. They're not putting features in place into their products because that's necessarily what anybody wants. And then when you start to think about, well, what is the, you know, what's the transparency around the relationship that exists between vendors and the advisory services, I think there's a lot of questionable stuff going on there because I don't know there's any transparency at all.
I think it's a fair point in terms of, I feel like that old question about do polls lead or do polls follow in politics. And if you do a poll that says that X is going to do well, is that a boost to them, or is it something that is a negative to them because people who fear that they're doing well will actually be energized to come and everybody, you know, the sophologists will argue, won't they? And the different political animals will argue, well, do you know what, that poll didn't help us because it showed that we were winning and it got the opposition out to vote because they didn't want us to win and all that kind of stuff. And it's a little bit like that. I think it's perfectly reasonable to say, absolutely, that if you get to a position of dominance in that market, and if what you make your pronouncement about whether something's good or bad, then those products and people will want to be on your good side, and they'll be dancing to your tune rather than necessarily their customers. I wonder though whether that's true anymore. I think it was probably true 10 years ago, and the kind of products that we talked about in the quiz where, you know, where software took a long time to develop and it was quite lumpy and there were fewer entrants in the market. But now things move much more quickly. I'm not entirely sure that people like Gartner can keep up with that. I'm not entirely sure they could keep up with it before, but I could make a better pretense of it. I just think they're too slow moving to hold that.
Yeah. And that's an interesting question then, is that actually do they promote the wrong behaviours that we should be seeing from technology leaders today? The days of lots of research to be able to make the right decision, surely now what we've learned in many cases now is it's better to just make a decision and start to learn through doing, and reducing the amount of time there is between an idea being identified and some sort of manifestation of that idea in reality. And that, you know, reams of research data is promoting a very wrong type of approach from senior IT leaders, because what they should be doing is say, how do we try this at a small scale with low risk and work it out for ourselves? Because contextually, we know, you know, sure, if you're doing, you know, I don't know, network routing or whatever, then it's maybe slightly less determined by the context of the organisation. Although even then, you know, this stuff shouldn't be overlooked. But when you get into any software that is used by people, until you put it into the context of the organisation in which you intend to use it, you don't know what's going to happen anyway.
I think that's true. But as a counter example to that, I think that there is value in doing your research up to a point, and it depends on the type of project you're starting. And because I have to use visual metaphors, I have always thought about, these are like ships sailing from this coast to that coast, and you've got, maybe you're crossing the Atlantic or you're doing something, you know, you're going on a long journey. And if you've got a big ship, it really matters which way you point it, because you are going to spend quite a lot of energy and it's going to cost you quite a lot to change that ship's course. It's better off going straight on. And also, because of its size and because of its weight, it is not going to be pushed around by the wind and the waves so much. So there's actually value in setting it off on course. Whereas little tiny boats, actually, it doesn't really matter whether you set them off on the right course or not, because they're going to have to tack, or they're going to have to change course because of the conditions that they find themselves in. So if you could spend all day lining up, you know, a small boat pointing in the right direction, and that within 5 minutes it will be off course anyway. So you're going to have to correct course. The big ones you do have to think about, because you actually get some value out of pointing them in the right way when you start. So I think it is worth doing the research. I think the research can have a lot of value. The question is more about, how do you get to know what's the right research for you and how to best use it, rather than taking that blanket approach, as you say, and trying to apply it to everything you do, because that's what you do.
Which then brings us on to my other big question about the world of advisory services, which is, why haven't they transformed themselves? Especially when so many of them spend their time, when they're not talking about products, and actually the product stuff, I think, is in, Is there less relevance there these days because of the differences in how you can, you know, adopt software without having to have massive capital investment and all the rest, which used to be the big block? But it's when they talk about how you should do things and what you should be doing at a strategic level that it starts to get a little weirder. And they talk about digital transformation, and yet I see very little evidence that any of these advisory services have even begun any steps in actually significantly transforming their organisations and their businesses for the realities of what an internet-connected, information-rich world looks like. They're still big paywalls, big access costs, and I'm not convinced that those are sustainable models. One question that I've posed to people that I know who work in these organisations is, why do they keep all of their content behind lock and key? That old media model of saying that our value sits in the IP. I subscribe to a few services these days, but the services that I subscribe to are hugely rich in terms of the breadth and depth of their information. Netflix is a massive amount of content that I'm subscribing to. Spotify is a massive amount of content that I'm subscribing to. And the amount I'm subscribing with them is relatively small. The question for me with an advisory service is, if the reports and the research that they do, why don't they start to free that up? There's a book that's influenced a lot of my thinking around sort of digital business models, which is called The Curve. And in that book, the core idea is, in the realm of the internet, the cost of distribution of content is basically zero. And if your cost of distribution of content is basically zero, you'll find that expectations amongst customers will be that it should be basically zero, because they can't see why it's costing you so much to be able to distribute the content. And then the second problem is that in that world where the cost of distribution is basically zero, the ability for your content to be ripped off is just, it's there and it's constant and you can't control it. So rather than thinking about putting increasingly complex ways of locking up your content, which also makes it less usable for people, and, you know, sticking everything in PDFs, for example, makes it really unusable, why aren't people thinking instead about making that content available for free and then monetizing disproportionately what in the Curve book is called the super fan, people who are willing to be able to spend disproportionately large amounts of money when the majority of people just take stuff for free? Because what then happens is all that content that they have becomes a marketing tool for being able to get people to become super fans. And the example they use is, you know, if you think about a rock star these days, the money from recorded records and selling content in that way is relatively slim these days, except for the most successful artists. But where there is money to be made is through live events, which not everybody who listens to the music goes to, but those who do will pay disproportionately for. That's the theory. That kind of thinking, to be able to actually really think about what a truly digital advisory service might look like, I don't see any evidence of that going on at all at the moment.
I think there's some value in what you're describing there. I think there are difficulties with that, in as much as if you are a publisher of books, if you just give your books away, how are you going to recoup the cost of publishing those books and also finding the authors that are worthy of, in your opinion, and this is what makes you a good publisher or a bad publisher, isn't it? Finding the authors that are worthy of exposure. And it's a bit like what we do here.
No, but hold on, because the book publishing world, the music publishing world, it was never that the cover price was really generating much money. The reason, if you take the music industry, books slightly different, but certainly the music industry's core business model was a venture capitalist model that was about making small bets of money in a large number of potential artists. Most of them would lose money, but they'd recoup quite a lot of it because it was all on advances that they would charge back. They'd also be able to make lots and lots of money through back catalogue on things like compilation albums. The reason why compilation albums were so big before the streaming services took over was because they were a cash cow for record companies. And then you'd have the few, the Britney Spears or the Elton John or whoever else, who would make a lot of money. But most record sales ultimately didn't make any money. And if you take out the distribution cost of printing, of producing bits of plastic and sticking them out into retail chains, that was just there to support the cost of the retail distribution for the most part. So it didn't make any sense in a digital world. And I'm certain that the, you know, most reports produced by Gartner will have tiny amount of consumption, individually won't be very successful, but if they actually released it to the outside world, there would be much greater impact of that content, and by having mind share of that stuff, you've got more chance to be able to sell services to a broader population.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying, and I think there's value in it, and I'm not dismissing it in that way, but I'm just thinking that at some point you've got to find ways of, and it might be that super fan or whatever, but put it this way, you and I have done hundreds of these episodes, and no super fan is sponsoring our lifestyle to the extent that we might like. You know, this is free, and that's it. I mean, that's the way it is. But it has
driven work for both of us.
It has, but not.
So that's the point.
Not because we do the podcast specifically. It's kind of obliquely led to work, but not
absolutely.
Said that. Get me those podcast guys.
So, but I think that there's a, you know, that for me though is that there's no thinking at all. This idea that intellectual property is a value in of itself seems to me still to be the core idea that underpins advisory service, and I think that model is dead.
I absolutely agree that there are different ways to go about things, and if you release your content often, you will get more out of it by doing that, because people will then start to see how much of an expert you are in these things, and then they will come to you for help and pay you to help to use that content in a better way, rather than try and do it themselves, because actually now they know where the experts are, and not only do they know where they are, they can see where the expertise is because they've got the evidence in front of them. So yeah, no, I do. I'm playing devil's advocate a little bit, but yes, I get it.
Let's just ask a final question on this then. Seeing as most of these services are about predicting the future, can we put our crystal balls on and think forward, and will we still see the likes of Gartner in the market in 10 years' time?
I think that's a really good question. I mean, I always had a slight antipathy towards Gartner, particularly because they take a fairly... I just don't enjoy the way that they assume that they are so often right when they're so often not. And I think they are going to have to change a great deal. I think, generally speaking, there's always room for people in a market who have spent time and effort to understand it and then be able to share that information with people who are maybe just starting out or are an expert in one thing. You know, you can get CIOs, to take this example, you get a CIO who comes in who's a project management background or ITSM background, and they don't know about other things, and they need some help to be able to reach that level in different aspects. So I think there's always going to be a place for that kind of service. The question is which of the providers will adapt to be relevant to the 21st century, because the model at the moment is fairly 20th century.
Yeah, it seems a fair analysis. I think the other thing for me is, will one of the big four consulting firms buy some of the big advisory firms, or will they move more directly competitively into the kind of advisory space, you know, research-based advisory space? And that might be something to watch out for as well, potentially.
Welcome to the end of our first double-handed episode for some time, Matt.
It is. We made it. I think there was something sensible in that. We'll see.
Yeah, well,
the numbers will tell us.
That's at the end of the day, that's what we're here to do. It's always good to get something off your chest, and I think we managed that tonight.
Absolutely. So that's it for another week. We have the live event coming up on May 2nd. It's very exciting. If you want to get along to that, it's taking place in the offices of Puppet over in Aldgate in East London, and we have only 3 tickets remaining. We might open up a wait. In fact, I have opened up a wait list already because there's some people who can't commit yet. So if you want to be able to come along to that event, where we'll be doing a live interview with Dario from Puppet to talk about some of the challenges of moving into a serverless world. And we will be doing some play with some of the priority cards that I've been working on for the last year or so. You'll go to the website, wb40podcast.com, and then we'll have a link on this show's episode notes so that you can go and get one of those final remaining tickets.
It's going to be a fantastic evening. Looking forward to it.
Yes, me too. So with that, let's say goodbye, and we will see you next week.
Thank you for listening once again. You can catch us, as always, on our website at wb40podcast.com. You can find us on Twitter at wb40podcast. And you can listen to us on all good podcasting outlets, such as iTunes, such as Stitcher, such as Spotify, TuneIn, you name it, we're there. And if you do find us there, do please leave us a review.